households coming together, not knowing who may have the virus, just scares me. Even if they say social distance or a mask, I'm not convinced fully. I understand, Chewy. Those are my concerns as well. I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hit.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Henricus Suroto teaches at a school on the Indonesian island of Java. When the coronavirus health crisis forced the school to close, he knew he could not move his classes online. His students live in rural areas that lack internet connections. Some do not even have a telephone signal. Instead, Suroto found another way to make sure his students keep studying. He goes to them. The 57-year-old teacher spends about 6 hours a day traveling by motorbike and on foot to reach communities in the Megalong area of Central Java. Suroto sees educating the children as a responsibility. "I am a teacher. It is my responsibility to do this. I must accompany and teach my students," he told Reuters news agency. His only concern seems to be the rain. He says it gets especially difficult going up and down valleys on rainy days. In the area where he works, many of the households are not set up to use technology. That is the case in large parts of the country, which is home to more than 260 million people. Indonesia has more than 17,000 islands. About 6,000 of them are inhabited, and many parts are rural. Millions of students, including those on the islands of Komodo and Madura, are struggling with homeschooling because their households lack basic technology. Some students are forced to go several meters outside their homes to connect to the internet. The country has around 60 million households, but only about 1 in 6 had an internet connection as recently as 1 year ago. That information comes from the Association of Internet Service Providers, Indonesia. "Well, I do not know what the internet is and other sophisticated devices that are often used nowadays," said Martinus Cartijo. He is father to a student in Henricus Suroto's class. Amasi, a mother of another student, is thankful for the influence the teacher has on her children. "The children listen and obey orders from their teachers compared to their parents," she said. For their part, students say they welcome the face-to-face meetings with Suroto, who wears a facial covering and obeys social distancing rules during his visits with students. "Studying at home sometimes can be difficult, sometimes easy, But if Mr. Sirota is there, all subjects become easy, said Albertus Jonas Weretama, a third grade student. I'm Alice Bryant.
Until this March, machines at the Rod Institute in Massachusetts were busy sequencing enough information for a complete human genome every 10 minutes. The DNA Sequencing Center is among the world's largest genomics labs. Genomics is an area of molecular biology concerned with the structure and mapping of genetic material of living organisms. When the disease COVID-19 started spreading in the United States, scientists at the Institute had an idea. What if their genome reading machines could be repurposed and used to test patient samples for the coronavirus? Over a period of 2 weeks in March, the laboratory reinvented itself. It went from sequencing the 3 billion letters of a human genome to sequencing the 30,000 letter genome of the virus. Today, the Broad Institute has the ability to carry out 35,000 tests each day. Broad is one of several genomics labs across the United States now being used as COVID-19 testing centers. Eric Green is director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, which provides money for many of these labs. He told VOA that preparing genome labs for COVID testing only required tweaking or small changes. It has been 20 years since the Human Genome Project produced its first working draft. In a White House ceremony on June 26, 2000, President Bill Clinton called the document the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind. The full genome was published 3 years later. That first map took scientists on 3 continents, 13 years, and nearly $3 billion to put together. Now, one lab can do it in a day or two for less than $1,000. Because of technology that made the Human Genome Project possible, it's actually quite trivial to sequence a given virus, Green said. In other words, sequencing something like the coronavirus is not especially hard to do. The virus was unknown until late last year. Chinese scientists had learned its complete genetic sequence by January 12th. The computing power developed to map the complete human genome is now being used to follow small changes in the virus's genome as it spreads. This gives us an enormous ability to track the virus, said Lee Hood, a co-founder of the nonprofit Institute for Systems Biology Research Center. Hood is also one of the inventors of automated DNA sequencing. Scientists are also studying coronavirus patients' genomes to learn why one patient might die, while another does not experience any signs of sickness at all. Green noted that the Human Genome Project created a change in the culture of science. That change can be seen in the actions taken to fight the coronavirus. When the Genome Project began in 1990, he said, team science in biology was not very popular. It was actually almost looked down upon, Green said. And sharing data before you publish your paper was almost unheard of. That's completely changed. COVID-19 research, Green added, is all about data sharing and open science.
As the novel coronavirus continues to spread in the United States, politicians are increasingly turning to technology to get their message out to voters. Public health guidelines for reducing the spread have led to changes in the political campaigns of President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Health officials have appealed to Americans to limit face-to-face contact with others. They support calls for social distancing, keeping space between yourself and other people outside your home. With social distancing rules in effect, the presidential election campaigns were faced with an unusual situation. They were no longer able to send out organizers and volunteers to connect with likely voters face-to-face. It has also not been possible for candidates to hold events that can raise millions of dollars for their campaigns. Eric Wilson is a technology expert working for the Republican Party. He directs the Center for Campaign Innovation. He told VOA the coronavirus health crisis forced big changes, such as the move to completely virtual campaigns. Just like the coronavirus disrupted everyone else's daily life, the same is true of our campaigns, Wilson said. Tara McGowan is the founder of Acronym, a political organization that supports progressive causes and candidates. She agrees that campaign organizers have had to find many new ways to reach the people most likely to support their candidates. You're just seeing a lot more creativity in terms of how and where the campaigns are finding the voters they need to get their message across to, McGowan told VOA. Since the start of social distancing orders in March, the Trump campaign has launched a daily talk show on social media. The show, which appears on services such as Facebook and YouTube, has different guests each day. Some well-known Republicans and members of Trump's family have appeared on the program as guests or presenters. During one show, the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., asked his father questions. That's one of the biggest kind of innovations we've done, said Aaron Perini, the director of press communications for the Trump campaign. The Biden campaign is also turning to social media to reach voters. It has used Instagram to hold discussions with well-known people and politicians. Last week, Biden raised more than $11 million during a virtual fundraising event with former President Barack Obama. Even as both campaigns experiment with ways to reach possible donors and voters, the use of technology in presidential campaigns is not new. Candidates have been using the Internet since 1996, the year presidential hopefuls first developed websites for their campaigns. In 2000, Vice President Al Gore, a Democrat, and Republican Senator John McCain held online chats during their presidential runs. By 2004, campaigns started experimenting with ways to use the Internet to connect with supporters and to help organize them, said Jennifer Stromer Galley. She studies political campaigns and the use of technology at Syracuse University in New York. In 2008, then-presidential candidate Barack Obama used social media services like Twitter and Facebook to help him win the election. Stromer Galley said the 2020 election season could be the first where campaigns spend more money on internet advertising than on television ads. She told VOA that internet-based ads are helpful in getting people to provide contact details after opening the ads. The first thing the campaign says is, "Hey, give me your email address." And if you do give your email address, they also then typically ask you for your name and maybe your address or your zip code. Stromer Galley said Facebook can be a useful tool for campaigns because ads can be created to target demographics of users. Facebook has built an algorithm that predicts if you're politically interested. They have an algorithm that predicts if you're likely a Democratic supporter or a Republican supporter. Aaron Perini of the Trump campaign says it runs a lot of ads on Facebook continuously. "We do a bunch of them, and those that are doing well, we'll put more money behind and continue to push those. Then others that aren't, you can pull them off the platform," she said. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Zachary Taylor, the 12th president. He took office in 1849. Taylor had some things in common with earlier presidents. Like six others before him, he was born in Virginia. Like George Washington and Andrew Jackson, Taylor was a war hero. And, like William Henry Harrison, he died in office. But Taylor brought at least one special trait to the presidency. Although he was officially elected as a member of the Whig Party, Taylor considered himself an independent. When Zachary Taylor was a baby, his family left Virginia. They moved west to a tobacco plantation in Kentucky. There, the Taylors were financially successful. By the time Zachary was a young man, his family owned a number of enslaved people and over 4,000 hectares of land.
Taylor took possession of some of his family's land. He also had cotton plantations in the southern states of Mississippi and Louisiana. He, too, depended on enslaved people to do most of the work. But Taylor was unlike many wealthy farmers in the South. He had always wanted to be a soldier. When Taylor was 24 years old, he became an officer in the U.S. Army. Shortly after, he married Margaret Smith. In time, they had 5 daughters and 1 son. But Taylor directed most of his attention to his military career. For about 20 years, he tried to keep peace between Native American tribes and white Americans. Sometimes the job meant leading attacks against Native Americans. At times, it meant defending their lands from white settlers. In either case, his public standing as a good soldier grew. His troops called him Old Rough and Ready because he was willing to fight and suffer alongside them. Then, in the Mexican-American War of the 1840s, Taylor became really famous. He led U.S. troops to victory in several major battles, including ones at Monterey and Buena Vista. In a well-known story, the powerful Mexican general Santa Anna surrounded Taylor and his small number of troops. Santa Anna sent a message demanding that they surrender. Taylor reportedly said, "Tell him to go to hell." The two sides clashed the next morning. Santa Anna had about 3 times the men that Taylor had. Yet, by late that day, Taylor's soldiers had defeated Santa Anna's. Taylor's success as a general helped the United States win the war against Mexico. In the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, Mexico agreed to give up claims to, or sell to the U.S., more than 1.3 million kilometers of its lands, including what are now the states of Texas and California. But the new lands almost immediately caused problems. At the time of the next U.S. presidential election, public opinion in the country was severely divided. The issue was whether to permit slavery in the new lands won at the end of the war with Mexico. In general, Northerners opposed expanding slavery. In general, Southerners supported it. To appeal to both these groups, the major parties at the time looked to Taylor to be their candidate for president. The Democrats and the Whigs reasoned that Taylor was already well-known and well-liked. Historian Michael Holt said, in 1848, Taylor was the most popular man in America. But Taylor was not really political. He called himself an independent. He shared some beliefs with both major parties at the time. But mostly, he wanted to keep the nation together. In the end, he agreed to be the candidate of the Whig Party. During the campaign, he did not take a stand on any of the major issues. His fame as a military general carried him into the White House. The truth was that Taylor did have an opinion on slavery. He did not want to expand it, especially in areas that did not support cotton or sugar farms. So, once in office, he proposed a change to the rules about how new territories would become states. The change would let white American male settlers in California and New Mexico decide whether they wanted slavery. Then those areas could enter the Union immediately as states. Taylor aimed to quiet the debate about slavery, but his idea angered almost everybody. Some U.S. lawmakers believed the president had cut them out of the decision. Northerners said Taylor's proposal did not go far enough. It did not solve some of the other issues related to slavery. And Southerners realized that settlers in California and New Mexico would almost surely reject slavery and give free states a majority in Congress. In one dramatic incident, some South Carolina officials called a meeting to discuss withdrawing from the Union. In answer, Taylor threatened to hang them. But before Taylor or his idea could get too far, the president became sick. The story is that he attended outdoor celebrations to mark the nation's birthday, July 4th. Then he went for a walk. The weather was very hot. To cool off, Taylor ate uncooked fruit and drank iced milk. That night, he told others about pain in his stomach. 5 days later, he was dead. His doctor wrote that Taylor died of cholera morbus, a general term for severe digestive problems. A few people thought he might have been poisoned. The suspicion remained until 1991, when medical officials examined Taylor's remains. They confirmed that he died of natural causes. A more recent study offers more details. Jane McHugh and Philip A. Makoviak say that Taylor was a victim of the same problem that killed Presidents William Henry Harrison and James Polk. Dirty water in the White House. Taylor's death, while unfortunate, did not cause a political crisis. John Tyler had already established the rule that if a president dies in office, the vice president becomes president. But Taylor's death did likely change the direction of history. His replacement, Millard Fillmore, did not try to hold the Union together by force. Instead, he joined with politicians who wanted to compromise on the issue. The compromise legislation delayed but did not really settle the debate. In time, the division between North and South led to the American Civil War. And members of Taylor's own family became linked to the states that withdrew from the Union. One of his daughters had married Jefferson Davis, who became the president of the Confederacy. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.